Hey everybody, this is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast. And it seems like about once a year I do an episode where I talk about my Laura and the Witch series. And how the time flies. Look at the calendar. It is time for another one of those episodes. So, I just finished my writer's conference that I go to every year, and sometimes somebody says something that really speaks to me, and sometimes I'm in a panel and I think, boy, I really should be somewhere else right now, writing. And there was one such panel this year where I was sitting toward the front and realized that this panel was not for me. It was not going to give me anything for my writing because it wasn't for writers. And because I was sitting at the front of the room, I didn't want to stand up and walk past all those people and make those on the panel feel bad. So I sat there. But the whole time I was stewing, wishing that I were writing. And I'll tell you what, both of those are good outcomes from going to the writers' conference. Hearing something that you need to hear that speaks just to you, that makes you go, oh, wow, I will try that. Or hearing something that you don't need and you think, boy, I wish I were writing right now. Both of them are useful because they're encouraging me to be a writer. There was a lot of encouragement. I know that the writers' conference I go to is more positive than most. And maybe that's why I keep going to it. But we've all heard of writers' conferences, writers' retreats, writers' classes. In fact, we've probably been in those if you've gone to a bunch where the guy says, how many of you would be a writer if you never got paid for it? You didn't make a dime. And then how many of you in this room feel like, well, if I'm going to write, then I need to be paid for it? He says, okay, all of you in the latter, you're not going to be writers. Find another job. Like, look at the person on the right of you and look at the person on the left of you. Okay? Both of those people are not going to make it as writers. And I understand why the instructor is saying that, because it is a brutal dog-eat-dog world out there. There was somebody on a panel that said, you know, writing is not a zero-sum game. Just because I get a publishing contract doesn't mean that you can't get a publishing contract. And then about 2 hours later, I went to a panel where the guy said, you know, sometimes people say that writing is not a zero-sum game. That if I get a publishing contract, then that doesn't mean you can't get a publishing contract. But it does. It's like each one of these agents, each one of these publishers has 100 slots, let's say. And they get 500 submissions every week. It's a zero-sum game. I thought that that was interesting, and I wondered if he had been in the panel where the woman said it's not a zero-sum game, and this was directly in opposition to that, because this guy is very much one of those. But there was lots and lots of encouragement, and there was lots and lots of how do you measure success? And none of us in here are going to become you-know-whos. Thank you. And have millions of dollars pouring in for our writing. We're just not. I am not here to set up your expectations in an unrealistic way. But you can still be successful to a lesser extent. You can still be successful in your own mind. You can still make a little bit of money as a writer. And I think that's what I needed to hear. You know, at one point, Marshall...
Where are you, Marshall?
Thank you. Said, "You're one of these days, you're going to be up on one of these panels." And it's like, you know, hi, my name's Rish Outfield, and people know me from the Laura and the Witch series. Something like that. And I just thought, well, I couldn't do that. I couldn't stand up with my head held high and say that I write the Laura and the Witch stories, because what if somebody doesn't like those? But every single one of those people on those panels has written something, published something that I wouldn't like. The most talented one on those panels has written something where I'd say, wow, this isn't good. because not everything that you write will appeal to everyone. Somebody said on the Saturday morning panel, I'll use Star Wars as an example, because everybody likes Star Wars. And I thought, no, not everybody likes Star Wars. Even something that changed the world like Star Wars did and was a phenomenon unlike anything that I have ever experienced. The biggest phenomenon that I was a part of was Titanic in 1997, 1998. And Star Wars was bigger than that. So not everybody is going to please everybody, but you need to know that your stuff will speak to someone because it speaks to you. Unless you're one of those a-holes that says, blank is popular right now. I'm going to write one of those and I'm going to make a ton of money. And every once in a while, one of those a-holes does make money by saying, oh, you know, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was popular, so I'm going to write something and something. But those are the exception. So I'm going to talk about my Laura and the Witch series as I do every year. And specifically, I'm going to plug Bundling Made Easy and Here to Help. The Laura and the Witch series is 11 years old, although it might have been 2012 when I came up with the idea of a little boy who discovers that his next-door neighbor is a witch. And he steals an amulet from the witch and tricks her into teaching him spells. It was an idea that I had that I was kicking around that I really liked. And sometime in 2013, I either wrote the story or finished the story. And by that point, the little boy had become a little girl, a 10 or 11-year-old girl. I think she was 11 in Like a Good Neighbor. And her name was Laura Deming. And she stole an amulet, a magical amulet, from her neighbor, Old Widow Holcomb. Holcomb was named after a girl that I had met that I thought was really pretty. Her last name was Holcomb, and I thought, she's pretty. She deserves immortality. It's an unfair world, kids. And Laura Deming essentially blackmails or tricks Old Widow Holcomb into teaching her spells. And the very first time they go out to do a spell, they go into the woods in the town and find some mushrooms that are growing. This is at night, and Holcomb casts a spell, and the mushrooms start to glow. And this has been a through line through all of my art. When it came time to come up with a cover image for Like a Good Neighbor, I thought, mushrooms glowing blue. And I've never really departed from that. I just like that image. And so when I wrote a second story a few years later that I called You're in Good Hands, I maintained that mushroom theme for the cover art. And there's not really any callbacks to the mushrooms themselves. Although, if I keep writing this series, I ought to bring them back again. I ought to have a story begin with Laura and Holcomb going out and gathering mushrooms in this town. And she remembers, you know, this was the first outing that we had when I was so much younger, so much smaller, so much more naive. Because I do the drops, I might as well mention that Abigail Hilton has a lot to thank for this series still existing.
Hilton for the stay.
Because at the end of Like a Good Neighbor, I had Holcomb get a second amulet, which essentially meant that Lara's amulet would no longer work on her. And the tables are turned, and Laura is going to meet an unpleasant end. That was my intention for the story from the beginning, even when Laura was a little boy. I was going to have the witch turn the tables on the boy and laugh sinisterly, and the end came up. It was inspired, I suppose, in part by that episode of Tom and Jerry, where Tom actually wins, and he eats Jerry and the little duck, the cutesy little duck that everybody loves. And I told all my friends about this Tom and Jerry, where the cat won, and nobody believed me, and they were right not to believe me. Because why would you do that? Why would you end an episode with the bad guy triumphant? Turns out once the internet came into being, I was able to look up that episode and find out that yes, indeed, one episode ended that way. And I felt justified, but all of the friends that I had lost over the years because of that argument, they didn't come back. And they all supported Trump in the next election. Anyhow, Abigail Hilton, thank you, had said that maybe it didn't end that way. My interpretation of the story was this. And I thought about it, and eventually I wrote a second story. By this point, I had brought Old Widow Holcomb back in an unrelated story that took place states away. I believe that the very first Laura and the Witch story took place around Seattle, someplace in Washington. And I had brought Old Widow Holcomb back in a story that referred to her and Laura Deming still being together, connected, even though they were far, far away. And so in You're in Good Hands, I constructed that. I came up with a villain inspired by what Abby had said, and I wrote a really solid story that I think is better than Like a Good Neighbor. It has more depth to it. It has emotion to it. It has twists and turns to it. It's an Empire Strikes Back, where it takes what was set up in Star Wars, and everybody loves Star Wars, and makes it deeper, makes it harder. Good stuff. But after that, after I had written You're in Good Hands, the genie was out of the bottle, and I just enjoyed writing these Laura and the Witch stories, and I've written about 10 of them over the years, in the 11 years that I have been writing this series, and most of the stories are little vignettes. I've shared a couple on this show. They don't really mean anything. It's just Laura has an experience involving magic, and everything's pretty much okay in the end. And I like writing those kind of stories. And maybe you like listening to them or reading them. If so, I've got a collection out there that is the first 5 stories. And it's just called Laura and the Witch, the collection, volume 1. The last story in that collection is one that I wrote just last year in 2023, and it's called Here to Help. And in that one, Laura is a freshman. For us, that is in 9th grade. She's 14 years old, and she meets a new witch, a witch that claims to be a friend to Old Widow Holcomb. And her name is Perpetua Trevorley. And Perpetua Trevorley came from a line in a story that takes place later, where Laura has a secret. And Holcomb is trying to guess her secret, and she said, "Did Perpetua Trevorley ask for your menstrual blood again?" And Laura says, "No. It was just meant to be a silly throwaway line." But like many silly throwaway lines, like the line in the story where the girl could see how people were going to die if she made eye contact, there was a line about Laura's family dying. And that has affected every single story I've written in the series since then. There is always a reference to her losing her family, because that is the worst thing that has happened to Laura. It's the worst thing that could happen to any girl or boy, you know, other than being killed by the witch next door, as was originally intended. But in 2023, I thought I would like to write a story about who is Perpetua Trevorley. And what does she want from Laura? And why would she ask her for that? So I wrote the story Here to Help. And it also played upon something that happened before the story The Company You Keep takes place. We mentioned that Laura had a best friend named Andover Sorensen. And I thought, well, Andover Sorensen isn't in the picture anymore. In fact, I had never mentioned her before. So I thought it would be nice to write a story that has Andover Sorensen in it, Lara's best friend. I'll probably insert her in another story, as long as I keep writing stories that take place when Lara is 14. But yeah, if you want to go and check out Here to Help, it is out there. And it's all right. I think all of these stories are all right. There's always something that I like in every single one of them. Partly it's because I like the dynamic between Holcomb and Lara. And I like to write for Old Widow Holcomb. I like the sort of old-fashioned, almost English way she has of talking. And it just comes from the way that I voiced her at the very beginning. It comes from the idea that somebody is 100-and-something years old, but they still look like they're 30 or 40 or 20 if she wants. And she's a cynical person with a cruel sense of humor, and Lara is young and innocent and naive. And so, they make strange bedfellows, if I'm using that phrase correctly. So, if you want to check out Here to Help, it is available. Just the text is currently available, although I have sat down and recorded it, and it will be available in an audio version of the first five stories of that collection that I mentioned. But that collection that I mentioned is also available in text form if you'd like to buy it. And I would appreciate it if you did. And now let me say a little bit about Bundling Made Easy, which is a novella that I wrote in the Lara and the Witch series. And I believe it was the third installment that I wrote. I did write some little vignettes that I've shared on here over the years, none of which I ever considered to be official entries in the series. Stuff like Fruish Memorial or the one where the guy encounters a child age Old Widow Holcomb at a Renaissance fair. Those weren't really considered by me to be segments in the series. I wrote Like a Good Neighbor, and then later I wrote You're in Good Hands, and then later I wrote Bundling Made Easy, and they were the three official novellas of the series. And then I went in and I started adding stories in between. You're in Good Hands, I think, takes place when Lara is 11 years old, and Bundling Made Easy takes place when she's 16. And there's a big stretch of time, and I started writing shorter stories, a couple of which I have included on here already. There's still so much space, so many years in between what was intended to be like a major story, as significant as You're in Good Hands. And ultimately, I didn't resolve the B plot in Bundling Made Easy, and I still haven't. I've written two stories that take place after it. One where she goes in to get her driver's license, to have her driving test, that takes place almost immediately after Bundling Made Easy. And then one the next year when she's a senior in high school and she's tasked with doing this 21 Jump Street kind of thing where she goes undercover at another high school as a new student. It's a story that I really enjoyed writing, and I would love to sit down and produce in audio. But like I said, she's a senior in high school there. All of these previous stories, including a bunch that I have yet to write, would take place before that. And that doesn't mean that you wouldn't enjoy reading these out of order. I always go back to the Robert Howard Conan stories, where he wrote one where Conan was young, and then the next one, he's an old, tired king, and then the next one, he's fighting for his freedom, and then the next one, he's a young king, and he just, and maybe he wrote them more in order and they were just published out of order. But I don't think so.
I guess the point I was trying to make is that you could still enjoy all the Conan stories no matter what order that you read them in. Whereas I think mine are a little bit more chronological. You know, I have lines in one story that refer back to a previous story. And a lot of times I will have lines in a story that inspire me to go back and write a story that takes place previously to explain that line. And I was thinking just this week about writing a story where she goes to Denver with Old Widow Holcomb, and suddenly she meets a bunch of new witches and finds out what their secret society is like and what they do when they get together. And I just thought, oh, this will be really, really fun. And she can say the wrong thing to the wrong one or feel like she can trust somebody when clearly she can't, and things can be dangerous for her. And then I just today came across a line in Bundling Made Easy, which again is written when she's a junior in high school, where she says, what do you do when you go to Denver? And Holcomb says, I'll have to take you with me the next time. And so that means I can still write that story, but it would have to take place after Bundling. And I have no problem with that. That would be fun. I guess this is why somebody would have an assistant or a manager? Who is the person who's in charge of making sure that your stuff is consistent? And, oh, hey, you called him Jacob here, but here you call him Jeff. You know, that kind of stuff. I know that there are podcasts by writers, like people who are much, much more consistent about their writing, or they're much more prolific about their podcasting, and they talk about writing. And yet, I feel like I've done it a lot. I feel like I've banged this particular drum a bunch of times. But writing is very, very interesting because it's not, well, in my experience, it's not predictable. It's not the same every single time. It's something that you get better at, and it's sometimes something that you get worse at. And it's always a challenge. There's always a new challenge on each thing. My brother-in-law likes to watch SportsCenter. And just as much as he likes to watch it, he likes to turn it on and then go downstairs or go to work and leave it on with no one watching. And in almost every single case of SportsCenter being on, there will be an analyst, a commentator that is on there and says, well, what the 49ers did was they went on there and they made a couple of plays. Now, I'm not sure why I'm giving them that accent, because somebody with that accent has no business being a commentator on television. Sorry, they need to be a congressman with that accent. But they'll get on there and they will discuss what the coach did wrong, what the players did wrong, and they analyze, you know, why one team prevailed over another. And to me, it's so very samey that it's unwatchable. I was just like, you guys have learned nothing. Maybe it's like Hollywood and nobody knows anything, but these guys always act like they do. And perhaps that's why I enjoy seeing movies come out and failing at the box office and then seeing other movies come out and succeeding at the box office, because it's unpredictable. And a lot of times you're like, wow, really? That movie did better than this movie. But if you sat down and said, okay, you can only bet on one movie, before the movies had been screened, you would have bet on the one that ultimately lost. I guess there are multiple factors, and maybe SportsCenter is the same way. Maybe if you love sports, you're like, okay, here's the thing. So-and-so was not playing his best because he had pulled a hamstring 3 weeks ago and it hadn't entirely healed or whatever. And if he had been back to his best condition, that team would not have lost. And if that team had not have lost, this is what would have happened in the next game and the next game. And maybe that is really, really interesting if you like sports. In the same way that I find box office interesting, but if you don't, you're like, oh gosh, why is he talking about that? Who cares if Ant-Man 3 overperformed and the Marvels underperformed? Who cares? But hey, you can like sports and you can be a writer and you can be somebody who doesn't give a crap about movies at all and still be a really good writer, still be an enthusiast of story. And maybe that's the thing is I am attracted to art and how certain things are put together and why some things work and some things don't. For example, songs. You know, I started doing this show where I talk about a song, and I do it on my Patreon, and I just heard The Longest Time by Billy Joel on the radio. And it's a song that I heard 100 times in the 80s and 70 times in the 90s. But you never really heard it anymore. And it struck me that it starts with the chorus. It starts with, whoa, for the longest time, whoa, for the longest, if you said goodbye. And then you don't hear that chorus. He goes verse, 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 bridge, verse, chorus. And I was just like, well, that's really an unusual order to have the song in. You know what I mean? I certainly think so. And I remember, I guess it was in the 90s, but it might have been in the O's, having a really hard time remembering what that Journey song was called. That went, just an uptown girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere. Oh, wait, let me do it as Neil Diamond. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. It took the midnight train going anywhere. I couldn't remember what the name of that song was. Because if the chorus is don't stop believing, hold on to that feeling, you don't hear that till the very end of the song. Do you know what I mean? The structure of that song is really, really unusual. But it works. I mean, I love More Than a Feeling. Nope. Don't Stop Believing. Thank you. Okay. So I guess I'm saying that art is really interesting and I like analyzing it and saying this is why this worked and this is why this didn't. I saw a movie just last week called It Comes at Night. And the sad thing is I can't remember why I watched it. I had told my friend Jeff that I sat down and watched it because the director had gone on to direct something that I really liked. And then I clicked on Wikipedia and no, I've never seen anything that the director had done. And I thought, well, why did I watch this then? There was some movie that I liked that somebody somewhere online compared to It Comes at Night. It was enough for me to say, oh, I've never seen that. I'm not even sure what that's about. So I'm going to sit down and watch it. And It Comes at Night is a very, very well done film that I ultimately did not like at all. There were choices that were made in the marketing of the movie and then also in the way that the story was told. But the marketing was really to blame. And the title was part of that marketing. It should not have had that title because it was misleading. The marketing campaign was misleading. If you see the trailer of the movie or if you see the poster for the movie, which I did see when the movie came out, it's of a dog barking at something in the woods, and instantly your curiosity is piqued. What is it the dog is barking at? It comes at night. Oh my gosh, what is it? It's a monster, right? Is it an alien? Is it the boogeyman? Is it a ghost? And somebody tells you, no, the movie is about a pandemic, like an epidemic, a super sickness that wipes out humanity. I'm like, oh, okay. But what is it from It Comes at Night? What is it? So just like Stephen King's The Stand, there is a super flu that wipes people out, but there's still a walking dude. There's still a boogeyman out there, right? That's what it is. Anyway, spoilers, I'm sorry. If you had any interest in seeing It Comes at Night, you already would have done so. So I call upon San Salieri, the patron saint of mediocrity, and I absolve myself. The movie It Comes at Night, there is no it. Well, you know, that's not even fair. There seems to be something that the dog was barking at, something that the dog goes after that we don't see, and then later the dog either returns to the house super injured, or whatever injured the dog returns it to the house. But we never see it. We never find out what it is. It's never fully addressed. There's not even speculated upon. Paranoia, ultimately, is the threat of the movie. There is a sickness, yes, and that is very bad, but the sickness has made people afraid and unable to trust one another. And again, I don't want to lambast the movie. It didn't suck. It was really, really well made. But I remain frustrated about the title and about all these questions that are posed in the movie and never answered. And I remember a lot of people having a problem with that with Lost, the TV series Lost, that it asks a bunch of questions that are not answered. But I would submit, Jana, that almost every single one of those questions are resolved on the show Lost. You just had to keep watching. Eventually, these questions were answered, and a lot of people refused to stick around. They wanted instant gratification. They wanted to know. It's like, what is the beast? How is there a polar bear on the island? What is the island? What is the story with the character who was clearly dead but was walking around on the island? You know, those are three questions, but I could come up with 30 if I wanted to. You know, how was Locke's legs healed? How was Locke's injury healed? These questions are all answered if you sit and watch. And maybe there was supposed to be an It Comes Again at Night movie that would answer all these questions. But I bet it all that there wasn't. It was just a misleading ad campaign. It wasn't great. Let me go back to being a writer, okay? Everybody is different as a writer. We all go at our own pace. There was that movie at the end of 2023 called American Fiction. And I'm not sure if you remember it. I mean, it got nominated for some Oscars by the time this comes out. It may have lost some. But Jeffrey Wright plays this struggling writer. He's struggling because his stuff doesn't sell, and he doesn't pander in his writing. He's a very educated person, but as a lark, as an FU, he decides to write under a pseudonym, this book about what it's like to be a black man in America, and it's filled with what they used to call ebonics back in the 90s, and violence and bastardry and all sorts of fun stuff like that. And he submits it as like a, you know, hey, this is the stuff you guys want to read. Well, F you. You all deserve to suffer. And then, of course, everybody loves it. Everybody thinks that it's genuine. He finds way more success with this book than he ever did under the books that he wrote with his real name or with his real passions. And it's fine. It's a very well-made movie. I enjoyed it a lot more than It Comes at Night, even though you're supposed to. It Comes at Night is supposed to make you unhappy. So in its case, it succeeded. But the thing I couldn't get over was, like, when did he write this book? Because we see him sitting down at a laptop and going like, F you guys, I'm going to write this, my pathology. And then he goes back and he changes the TH to an F, so it's my pathology. We see him write like two or three sentences, you know, in broken English. And then the book is done in the next scene and submitted. And I thought, but this was written by a person who knows how long it takes to write stuff. But, you know, that's not true. Writing a screenplay, you could write a screenplay in a weekend, no problem. You could write a screenplay in a day, no problem. It would be difficult, but you could do it. And yet, I got the impression that we were to understand that Thelonious, the main character, wrote that in a weekend. He wrote a novel in a weekend, or, you know, in an all-night writing binge. But I can't dismiss it 100%, because there are people who write way, way, way faster than me. Big Anklevich can write a novel in a month or 5 weeks or something like that. And you go, well, Rish, come on. The stuff that you call a novel is hardly a novel. Well, you know who you are. One of my listeners did tell me that the first time that I wrote a book and it crossed the 40,000 word mark. I was just like, I wrote a novel. She said, that's not a novel. Come on. But what Big writes is a novel. It'll be 60, 70, 80, 100,000 words. And he is able to write it like that. And then, you know, there are people who are much slower than I am, that have a much harder time even than I do of getting the words on the paper. And to them, 1,000 words in a day would be a huge accomplishment that would take hours. And I'm not saying I'm better than you or you're better than me or anybody is as good as Big Anklevich. I'm just saying that we go at different paces. And what might be right for you might not be right for some. You know, a man is born, I think it's fair to say that he's a man of means. Then along comes you, and you got nothing but your peen, basically. Sorry, you see what I did there? I've told the story, right, where William Shatner says, did you see what I did there? And I was just like, only William Shatner could get away with that. Anybody else, you'd be like, you are such a piece of crap. Yes, we saw what you did. Sorry. Anyhow, I've been finishing up the audio for Bundling Made Easy, and I stumbled upon this scene that was kind of like a contradiction, a self-contradiction. I'm not sure what you would call it, but when Stephen King was writing The Green Mile, he would write it one section at a time, and he published it as he went. I'm not sure if people remember this, but in 1997, he published all of The Green Mile in installments, once a month. And I think there was a month that it was late, by, you know, like a week or 10 days. But when we got it, there was one volume that was slightly longer than the other volumes. I'm not sure if I'm remembering it right, but it seems like all of them were the same price, except for that one volume, which was a dollar more. Anyhow, while King was publishing this, somebody brought to his attention that he had made a mistake in one of the earlier segments where this character of Percy Wetmore was in a straitjacket so that his arms were stuck behind him. He was not able to use his arms, and yet he wipes his nose with the back of his hand in that scene. King drew attention to it in the intro to one of the other books, one of the other installments, where he said there was this famous part in Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, where Robinson stripped naked, and then he swam to a neighboring island, and he gathered up, I'm not sure if it was rocks or what it was that he gathered, there was something on this island. He gathered up all of them, stuffed them in his pockets, and swam back. And this book was written in the 1700s, right? And it had survived all these years with this discrepancy in it. And King says, I assure you that when The Green Mile is collected in a single volume, I will have fixed that part. Anyway, I discovered a bit that was like that, where Lara encounters this guy. He's really unhealthy, and he's got a terrible haircut. In fact, she suspects that he cut his hair himself. And then he turns to go and stumbles, and his baseball cap comes off. And I thought, oh, wait, but when she first met him, she thought that he might have cut his own hair. His haircut was so bad. But if he had a baseball cap on, ooh, that's a discrepancy. And I didn't know what to do about it. I could just cut the bit about the hair. Or, I mean, you know, if somebody said, fix this, you have to fix this, I would just have that he, when she encounters him, he's holding a dirty baseball cap. And she sees his hair. And then a minute later, he puts on the baseball cap. And then when he runs, the baseball cap falls off. And maybe that's why he was holding it, is because it kept falling off his head. It doesn't fit properly. That's totally cromulent. Totally. In fact, that's what I'm going to do. Why did I bring it up then? Well, it brought me to the decision that I needed to fix that mistake. But there are going to be other mistakes in that series, inconsistencies between them that I don't catch. And maybe you will catch them. It's frustrating, right? When you make mistakes like that, but it's also inevitable because I am human. And I need to be loved just like everybody else does. Oh, shut your mouth. How can you say? Okay. I guess the whole reason I brought it up was today I discovered that reference that she had never gone to Denver with Old Widow Holcomb. And I don't like that. She should have gone along to Denver to find out what her foster mother is doing years before. But I still want to write the Denver story. In fact, I feel like in The Company You Keep, which takes place her sophomore year in high school, so a year before Bundling Made Easy, she mentions the other witches that she met in Denver. I feel like that's the case. In which case, do I change the line in Bundling Made Easy while I have the chance? It doesn't affect anything in the story, in the same way as when Percy Wetmore had the straitjacket on and he was unable to move his arms, the fact that snot was running down his lip and he wiped it with the back of his arm, it didn't change anything in the story. And it, you know, it didn't ruin that scene. It's just a little inconsistency. Oh, well. If you want to go out and buy Bundling Made Easy, I would really appreciate it. I think it's good, but, you know, only if you really like the Laura and the Witch series. And as I've said before, multiple times, there are a bunch of Laura and the Witch stories. And every time that I read one, narrate one, publish one, it gives me an idea for another one. It's fun in that way. It's kind of like the Hydra. And so if you like them, let me know, and I will try to put more on the show, and that will probably inspire me to write more of them. Anything that inspires me to write more is good, in my opinion. As it stands, I'm almost done with a story called Here to Help. I'm almost done publishing it. And you, if you want, you can go out and get that, too. I just, I don't have enough focus to write a novel a month. I don't have enough focus to do that. And so sometimes I just have enough focus to write a story. And so if there is a particular series that you love, if you really, really want me to finish The Calling, which, you know, is only supposed to be a trilogy, and I never wrote the third part, you need to let me know. And I will try and move it up on my priority list. Because there are fewer years ahead than behind. And that probably means there are fewer stories ahead than behind. And so, let me know. And you, in your own artistic endeavors, remember that there are fewer stories ahead. And so, see if you can get in a couple extra ones before the deadline. I almost forgot. I have to put this in because this is the reason I wanted to do this episode. There was a part at the end of Here to Help, my audio production, when I really, really moved myself, and I surprised myself by how moved I was. Luckily, I was recording at the time, and so I can share that with you, even though it's a little embarrassing. But hey, because I went to this conference, I'm feeling willing to put myself out there. Enjoy.
Well, the point stands, Malcolm grumbled. If I knew the spell, and I don't know it, that would bring your sister back, it might well steal your life from me. And then where would we be? Lara considered it. You could teach Emma spells. And people would look at you with her and say, I'll bet that's her daughter because they're both so pretty. I'll bet that's her daughter. Lara considered it, her emotions rising at the thought of being dead while her sister was alive. You could teach Emma spells. I bet she'd listen to you way more than I did. And people would look at her, and people would look with, and people would look at you with her and say, I bet that's her daughter, because they're both so pretty. Her voice cracked at the last part. She didn't know why. Don't you say that.
So, I mentioned at the beginning that I also put out a collection that includes the first five stories, including Here to Help. And then the next story chronologically after Here to Help is The Company You Keep. But I think there's room for way more stories. And that's something that's really unique about writing this series is every time I write a story, I get an idea for another story. One that could be told. And when I was writing Here to Help, there was this little line about, well, Lara had a nightmare. And Holcomb thought that she was dreaming of goblins again. And Lara thinks she hadn't had a nightmare about a goblin for almost a year. Although there had been about 100 nights before then that she had dreamed of goblins. And that seems like a story right there. There should be a story to be told in that. And then in Bundling Made Easy, Holcomb goes off to Denver for some kind of witch's council business. And I had always had this idea that Holcomb makes money by selling charms, by selling potions at some kind of farmer's market, but for witchcraft. And I had had the idea that it was in Denver. I thought that there was potential for a story, and the first time that Lara goes along with Holcomb and gets to see her world, the kinds of people she deals with, and obviously there would be goblins involved. But there's a line in Bundling Made Easy, which takes place when Lara is 16 years old, that says that she's never gone with her to Denver. And so I was frustrated by that. I was like, oh no. Well, I guess I can write a story where she goes along with her, but she'll have to be 16 or older. But then I thought, no, I'll just throw in a line that Holcomb does her business in Colorado Springs, but the witches' council meetings are in Denver. And that way it's two different things. Lara could have gone to Colorado Springs with the witch, but never been to Denver for one of these other things, which she would not be allowed to go to anyway. And so there's a story there. I would like to write a story about why she is afraid of goblins. And then there's one other story idea that came to me while I was recording Here to Help. It's she was going through a bunch of her things, and she found like her old retainer case. She found, was it a yearbook? She found the seashells that Holcomb had given her to communicate with. Although that one might have been in Bundling Made Easy, not in Here to Help. And she finds the box that her little glowing friend, which was the Christmas present that Holcomb gave to her the first Christmas they were together in the story Made Just for You. And there's just this one throwaway line. Here is the box or the container or the bottle she used to keep her little glowing friend in. But that insinuated that the little glowing friend was gone. And so I thought, okay, well, there's a story
that I can tell. And that one can take place when Lara is like 13 or, you know, right before her 14th birthday or something like that. And maybe I could combine those and she loses that comfort animal, that friend that Holcomb gave her in that Christmas story when she goes to Colorado Springs. Maybe the glowing friend sacrifices its life for her when goblins are bothering her or coming after her. I mean, that's two birds with one stone right there. And again, that's why I like writing these stories so much. I like the two characters, but I also like that there is a multitude of story potential in this idea of a regular human girl being raised by a witch. I mean, there are even times that I think about going back and writing a story that takes place before You're in Good Hands, where her family is still alive and Lara's just casting spells and learning lessons, casting the wrong kind of spell, or having a spell that with good intent and it goes bad, or casting a spell with bad intent and learning, hey, you don't do that. It is really fun to do, and maybe, just maybe, it is fun to read them. You get some of that. It rubs off on you, the reader, you, the listener. Feel free to buy a copy of Mundling Made Easy. Feel free to buy a copy of Here to Help. Feel free to buy a copy of the first five-story collection, which is called Lara and the Witch, the collection, volume one. And I've got a story that I started writing before Here to Help in 2023 that I never finished. And it takes place right after Bundling Made Easy, when Lara is about to get her driver's license. And I didn't finish it. I put it down and I started Here to Help. And thank goodness I at least finished one of the three stories that I started in 2023. But it's now 2024. And so I'm going to set one of my goals to finish that story that I started, the one that takes place when she's 16. And then, you know, I've already started on my way to a second collection, haven't I? And sometime this year, while I'm feeling ambitious, and that's why you pay money to go to those writers' conferences, is so you can come out of it refreshed and energized and feeling like, hey, I can do this. But another thing that I need to do is that I wrote a Lara and the Witch novel, and it was called When You Need It Most. And that one takes place a year later, when Lara is 17, she's a senior in high school, and she is given her first task by the Witch's Council, her first mission, if you will. And what I would really like to do is sit down and record all of that and put it out, and do another episode where I plug that and try and get you to buy that. Because I think a couple of you would really like this story. I like this story. All right. I will be back soon with more Rish Outcasts. We are in the era, is that the right term? When I'm going to be presenting 10,000 Coffins. I started it last summer and I still haven't put it out. So I need to buckle down and do that, and I think you'll like those episodes too. As always, I have a Patreon fund you can support. You can just give me $1 an episode, but you can give me more than that if you want to, and it encourages me to continue to put these out. It encourages me to put stuff out that's just for the Patreon supporters. Every month I have tried to do an episode of Rish on Records about a song. Kicking around ideas for what next month's song will be. You can always give suggestions. I'll probably not do them, but maybe they will inspire me to do a song like that or by that artist. Or maybe there's a song that I had heard and never understood the lyrics to. And that's kind of what that little show is for, is, hey, let's take a look at the lyrics on this and see if we can figure out what they mean. Anyway, once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me and Lara Deming and Victoria Holcomb. And all three of us will be back again
someday soon. Good night.
The Rish Outcast was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which makes it free to listen to, share, and poke fun at. But the podcast cannot be altered or sold.
Logo by the talented and generous Gino Moretto.
If you didn't completely despise this episode, why don't you support the show with our Patreon fund over at patreon.com? Every dollar gives me more strength to put Outfield in his place.
Not until the day before he had left had Eustace had... Not until the day before he left had... Not until the day before he left had Eustace... Not until the day before he left had Eustace an opportunity. Not until the day before he left had Eustace an opportunity of observing Adrian Borlsover's newfound faculty. I suppose that it would be necessary to have a billiard room. I suppose that it would be necessary to have the billiard room fitted up. I suppose that it would be necessary to have the billiard room fitted. I suppose it would be necessary to have the billiard room fitted up with bookcases. Fitted up with bookcases.
When we went to senior ball and danced to that old Adam Bryan song, I saw 100 girls watching us out of the corner of their eye. My eye. They would have gladly ditched their dates. Yeah. I was going to leave in that mistake. I saw 100 girls watching us out of the corner of my eye.
I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. You and I can move into the city. Wait. And find a way to move into the city. You and I can both get jobs. Finally see what it is to be living. I remember you were driving in your car, speed so fast, felt like I was drunk. City lights laid out before us, and your arms felt nice wrapped round my shoulder, and I had the feeling that I belonged, and I had a feeling I could be someone. Cut that bit out, would you, Rish? It's embarrassing.